Yes. All right, so we're on to the next agenda paper. So this is about agenda paper one, maximum period to consider when measuring expected credit losses, which is another paper where I suspect we're going to have to distinguish between what the words say and what we might want the words to say. But with that, I'll hand over to Bernadette.
Okay, so agenda paper one. Okay, so agenda paper one focuses on a question raised regarding the maximum period to consider when measuring expected credit losses. So IFRS 9 limits the maximum period to consider when measuring expected credit losses to the maximum contractual period, including extension options, over which the entity is exposed to credit risk. So the submitter questions the application of this requirement in the context of a portfolio of mortgage loans managed on a collective basis and where individual credit reviews are not undertaken. So the loans in question have a stated maturity of 6 months, but also contain a contractual feature whereby the term is automatically extended every 6 months unless the lender objects to it. However, due to the way in which the portfolio is managed, the lender does not in fact exercise this contractual right to prevent extension unless information about an adverse credit event regarding a specific borrower has been received. So the submitter firstly notes that in accordance with the requirements of IFRS 9, the maximum period to consider when measuring expected credit losses would be restricted to the stated maturity of 6 months. However, the submitter then questions whether, in that particular case, a longer period should be considered, given that the lender does not, in fact, have this practical ability to prevent extension on a timely basis. So, having considered the analysis presented by the submitter, we would just highlight a number of the areas of guidance, which we will be, as Sue said, perhaps dragging you back to. So as the submitter already notes, IFRS 9 does limit the maximum period to consider when measuring the expected credit losses to the maximum contractual period, including extension options over which the entity is exposed to credit risk. And IFRS 9 goes on to state that it should not be a longer period, even if that period is consistent with business practice. And so the one and only exception to this general requirement relates to specific financial instruments that include both a loan and undrawn commitment component, and for which the entity's contractual ability to demand repayment and withdraw the undrawn commitment does not limit the entity's exposure to credit losses to contract the contractual notice period. And an example of a portfolio of that nature may be a revolving pool of credit card facilities. And so in this case only, a period in excess of the contractual commitment period is permitted by IFRS 9. And furthermore, the basis of conclusions of IFRS 9 does contain considerable discussion pertaining to the ISB's redeliberation on this matter. And the outcome of that discussion was the ISB's reaffirmation that using the maximum contractual period over which the entity is exposed to credit risk was the conceptually correct outcome in all cases, bar this one very limited exception. And so we just would be interested in your views on our reading of the words in IFRS 9 and also in the context of this particular example.
Okay, so who wants to go first?
Thank you. I think the first bit is more in terms of the interpretation. I think that comes through as you described, that the interpretation is quite clear. Now, this doesn't fall into that exception category, which is 5520. And then in 5519, it is quite clear in terms of the definition that you are limited to the maximum contractual period. And even though, and I said, as you mentioned earlier, that might be against what you'd see from a behavioural perspective. The interpretation is quite clear. I think the two points I wanted to raise, the first one goes, I think, more to the way that the example is phrased, where they speak around that it might be limited to 6 months, but the concept of an automatic extension. So the only question I have, almost in the makeup of the loan and what they determine to be a maximum contractual period, whether that can be questioned in terms of the concept that the the loan is automatically extended. The other bit that I wanted to bring up was if, as we state, we're limited to 6 months, it comes more to the measurement in terms of how you measure the probability of default, so that you might look at an exception at the six-monthly point, because you have to consider in terms of what is the potential of default should the obligor not be able to repay the loan at that particular point.
And when you read the words in IFRS 9 on your point about there's a sort of automatic extension but for the lender choosing not to extend, do you think that that matters or not based on the words in 9?
I think in terms of the words of 9, it is quite clear. So I think in terms of going back to the words, or pulling us back to the words, it does come through quite clearly. But I always question in terms of, in terms of depending on the loan itself, you'd have to actually look at the terminology in terms of the loan quite carefully to ensure that does it meet those requirements.
Okay, so Alan, does Alan?
Based on the current IFRS 9 principles and the examples mentioned in the staff paper, we agree that the maximum period to consider when measuring ECL in accordance with Para 5.5.19 should be the maximum contractual period, that is the 6 months. And we believe that a bank will normally monitor and alert its own credit risk while using the risk models in the course of risk management practice. The forward-looking and macroeconomic factors are incorporated while designing those risk models, so that the bank could actively manage its credit risk during its the contractual period of the credit assets. And also, the bank has a right to refuse the extension of the current contract and contain its exposure at risk while adverse effects are identified. Also, we think with regards to the pricing, and the bank will set up the interest rate at its contractual period, which is 6 months as well. And also, I want to talk about a little bit about the Chinese situation. There is a relatively longer contractual period for the mortgage loan in China at the moment. We don't have a very short term of credit loan at the moment. So usually it would be 20 or 30 years at the moment. The borrowers will be able to choose to repay the loan earlier than its maturity. However, with the development of the economics, we are looking forward to see varieties of the products, in the future. And in that case, we believe this discussion around this topic will be a very good reference point. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
If I can break my comments down into two bits. One is the conceptual discussion around 5519, subsequently about practicalities on measurement. And to the extent we discussed the conceptual issue, I think until recently, people have been pretty much in the camp, well, the standard would say it's 6 months under 5519, and that's it. I think two sort of additional thoughts that have arisen recently is one to, I guess, understand perhaps, well, why would 5520 not apply? And I guess we sort of, when you read the supporting text, it talks about revolving credit facilities and something having both facility having both a drawn amount and an undrawn amount. And I guess very simply, you might think, well, there's a facility of 150, 100's been drawn, 50 is yet to be drawn, and that's maybe the sort of circumstance that was considered. But we've come across practice issues where people say, well, I've got something that fits 5520, but maybe as of today, zero has been drawn, or perhaps maybe as of today, the full 150 has been drawn. And I think we would say, well, 5520 would still apply there, because actually, okay, maybe you've got a 3 month revolver and you've drawn the full amount of the facility for the current 3 months, but at the end of 3 months, then the new undrawn commitment will kick in. So how does that fit with this scenario where, okay, it's like you've got a loan for 6 months and then a commitment to lend for another 6 months, obviously. So that's, I guess, a conceptual point around 5520. The other thing is the phrase maximum contractual period, because these are the contractual terms, but it could be that these are residential mortgage loans. We don't quite, I think, at the moment understand, well, what's the position of the regulator? You know, would there be other features in the legal system or how the bank has to conduct its business that means that maybe it would not be able to just call the loans at the end of 6 months? And that in terms of understanding what the maximum contractual period is, you'd need to consider the surrounding legal and regulatory framework to understand that term. On practicalities, which is sort of dealt with, I think, in 14B of the agenda paper, let's say you go with the view that the answer is 6 months for the remaining, what's left of the remaining 6 months. And I guess we talked to people, well, how will you apply measurement in these cases? And I guess some people have said, well, okay, what we'll do is we'll assume that we ask all the borrowers for repayment at the end of 6 months, which is a bit strange because that's not what is actually expected, and you're not going to have any historical data based on making such demands. It seems an odd way of approaching things. Other people have said, well, yeah, we agree conceptually the answer is 6 months, but what we'll do is we'll make an assumption that we're going to extend, and any credit losses we think that would come from the extension, we'll treat those like they're associated with the default at the end of 6 months, which just seems to be totally inappropriate in terms of the analysis. And I guess, I mean, what we perhaps think about is, you know, what the SAM would mean. If you think the answer is 6 months, well, you're going to have to build your, whether it's stage one or stage two, you're going to have to build your ECL based on the chance of a default happening during the next 6 months. And that probability will also reflect the fact that you may extend and you sort of get a free pass over the extension.
Anyone have anything to add to what George?
Well, we thought in paragraph 5.5.19, where it says including extension options, it might be a clarifying point to say at the option of the borrower. I don't think it matters really what the lender necessarily wants or has an option to. And I think there is some confusion about that out there as to that doesn't say exactly what I just tried to insert. And so, can I literally consider any extension options? And then I think the I think what people are concerned about is the opportunity here for structuring. That's possible. Now, these systems have been set up, when I read this and this example, I thought, why as a borrower would I ever want to sign up for this thing where I could be kicked out every 6 months? But I assume there's good reasons why these things, and in Canada, we have 5-year renewal periods for mortgages, where the bank could say, we're done with you. But the issue keeps coming up, but what about the refinancing risk that comes with that? Legally, contractually, we can, but practically, we may not be able to exit some of these things, and should that be considered? But reading the standard, I don't think there's an argument for that. And so we are stuck with, if the contractual period is 6 months in this case, then it's 6 months. If it's 5 years, it's 5 years, and you can't go beyond that.
I'll make a couple of observations, and I'd be very keen on others chipping in, looking at my fellow board members in particular. In terms of your suggestion that having had the words including borrower's extension options added in rather than just leaving it as extension options, I hear what you're saying, and if I didn't have an issued standard, then maybe that would be a nice addition. But I guess we read the words maximum contractual period over which the entity is exposed to credit risk to mean that you wouldn't be exposed to credit risk. Well, you would be exposed to credit risk if it was within the borrower's control, whereas if it was within the lender's control, you aren't exposed to credit risk. So we find, so maybe it would have helped people to have an extra steer, but I would have hoped that we
I agree with you about that.
The same place, and if we all agree that's what's meant, then these hopefully the sort of summary of the discussion will help people understand that. In terms of the structuring risk, and also going back to Chris's example, which was sort of the sort of legal environment in which you're operating and whether that has a factor, I guess the only thing thought there, and this is where others please chip in if you disagree or agree, would be that anything in IFRS requires you to be based on what's substantive. So just having a sort of contractual term in there that's completely ineffectual isn't something that you should be using. So I think that that means that you do need to consider the environment in which you are operating. I know that that's not as nice as having it written there in black and white, but you know, we've had other discussions in other contexts where, you know, you can't have fake terms in here. You need to have something which is real, that really does mean that you are or are not exposed to credit risk. That would be my gut reaction to that one. But Steve, Martin, Kumar, would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. When I'm looking at the terms, if there are other terms around which actually basically extends it or shortens it, whatever way it works, I cannot just ignore those, but it will be based on those contractual terms. It's not, use a worse word, based on expectations, but that's how the contractual terms work in that jurisdiction in the broader context. Yes, that's what I would agree.
Graham, I think you were next, and then I'll come to you, George. Graham?
Thank you, Sue. Yeah, actually, that was exactly the question we were going to talk about, is should we consider whether or not the terms are substantive? Because, you know, when you really step back from this, it feels a lot like a six-month repricing variable rate long-term mortgage loan. Now, to the degree that that's true probably depends on, you know, really the regulatory ability to act on, let's say you had a borrower that was performing perfectly on a very low-rate loan, and you decided that that wasn't economically what you wanted to be involved in anymore. You could reinvest those funds in a more advantageous way. So you call the bond, or you call the loan. Well, from a regulatory perspective, I know at least in North America, that would be a real problem, right? Kicking performing borrowers out of their homes is generally not something that's smiled upon. And so, you know, to the degree there's not some sort of indication of credit risk, it seems a little bit like likely an unsubstantive term was our initial read of it. So,
George.
So to get to your point about substantive, because substantive versus contractual, contractual is a legal reading, it's an option. The thing that troubled me about the fact pattern on page 6 of the paper was this concept of an automatic extension feature, which made it sound like it was kind of on remote control. It wasn't something that they actually did anything meaningful to reevaluate. But I look and say, but if it's contractual, it's contractual. Whether they do anything meaningful or not doesn't make it, you know, not substantive.
Yes, exactly.
No, I agree.
Now, do you agree with that?
I
yeah?
Absolutely.
So
okay.
Just because you are not particularly on top of monitoring every 6 months and sort of actively managing it, that's one thing. You've still got the right to do it, and I would distinguish that differently from a situation where, as a matter of law, if you actually tried to exercise that right, someone's going to say, you've got to be joking, you can't do that in this jurisdiction. So I think it's not the fact that you're not doing it, it's the fact that you don't have the unilateral right to do it.
Okay, so the contractual part, though, to me, is a legal reading
yes.
of what the requirement is. And as long as there's not another law that trumps it, or for instance, then we, you know, the substantive stuff I think is
yeah.
perhaps
yeah.
a bit confusing. Okay,
which is,
all right.
Which is a fair point.
Fair point. That's exactly. There's nothing else that's trump if there's something else not trumping. Yeah.
The environment matters. Okay. Are we okay with that? In which case, John. Sorry.
That's very helpful in terms of the substantive point and the interaction with the regulator, because that's my main concern. But I just come back to one point that Chris raised about the definition of a non-drawn commitment.
Oh,
it would be
yes.
helpful if you gave us your perspective on that. And
not meant to be giving perspectives.
But well, no, just to because you know, one could say that there is a non-drawn commitment in this. It's undrawn in the context of time. And I was very taken with Chris's analogy where you have a revolver and you're right up against your limit. That's clearly a revolver, and I think that was intended to be caught by 5.5.20. But I just wonder, you know, in the way the words are phrased now, you know, do we have a non-drawn commitment here? Just in terms of the actual words of 5.5.20.
Speaking as one person, Sue Lloyd, individual
yeah.
board member, cannot bind the board. The way I would think about it would be that if the terms of your instrument are that you have a facility where you have the right to be between 0 and 100 during the term of that facility, if at the particular reporting date you're either at 0 or you're at 100, doesn't change the fact that you have a facility which gives you the capacity to have undrawn and drawn components. So I think it's the fact that you have a revolving facility, those are the terms and conditions that we were thinking of, as opposed to as at the reporting date it's fully drawn, therefore I don't have an undrawn component, therefore 5520 doesn't apply, if that was the concern. Was that the concern? Or have I misunderstood?
So what you're saying there is, in terms of, I think, applying 5520, you're saying, well, I sort of stand back and like look at the whole facility and how I expect it to operate over time. So you're saying, well, okay, I could draw down between 0 and 100, and that's how the thing's expected to operate. The fact that today I've drawn down 100 doesn't change that. The fact
and even
that
if I thought it was going to be 100 over time, I think you'd still be in. It's the fact that, in theory, it could be less. And it's, so it is the type of facility that has the capacity to oscillate that's the key.
Right. So in applying it to this, now I imagine that this loan is for a fixed amount, but I imagine that the borrower can choose to repay. I don't know whether he could reduce the amount. I don't know then if he's only got the ability to draw more, probably not. But is that what you're drawing? Is that, I guess, where you're drawing the distinction is, that ability to oscillate rather than
I think
static or go down?
Well, if I go back and thinking, and hopefully my memory serves me well, in terms of the board paper that led to this, the people, when they wrote to us about the proposals in the last ED, where we had said it's a hard maximum contractual period and you cannot look beyond that, people came back with two main arguments. One was that's not very economic, and the other was, and it's difficult for us to do because that's not how our statistics work associated with that. And the second thing they came back with was it's particularly difficult for us if we have a facility which could be partly drawn, partly undrawn, because we think of it as a whole and you're telling us to think about it in a very sort of artificial way for the undrawn bit, and it's hard because I'm thinking about the whole exposure because I don't differentiate between the on and the off balance sheet pieces. So I think and so we said, okay, we understand your conceptual point, but we still believe the maximum contractual is an important thing in the model. But because in addition you've got this practical problem for these revolving type of facilities, for those types of facilities we will do something. So from my recollection, I'm hoping Bill's nodding because he was one of the people we talked to closely at the time, 5520 was designed, you know, it's always difficult because you can't write down for revolving facilities because, you know, who the heck knows what that means. So we tried to describe what we meant, but I think it was the capacity to be drawn and undrawn that we were focusing on, from memory.
Yeah, man, I agree with you, because, man, that was these two elements, I think, was really the dividing factors, what we said, okay, we need an exception here, which is limited if that is really, it was clearly, based on my recollection, not what you said, okay, if it is 100% drawn and maybe for a period 0% drawn, I think that cases were not what we discussed and were we not, I think, have done the exception. And it was these two elements were to describe where we said, okay, it is a practical difficulty, and therefore we said, okay, we should maybe not use a contractual, we should look at different things. But it was not, I think, what you said, okay, if it is then maybe for a period 100% and then 0 and then we don't 100%, that is not, I think, what we not had in mind when
Steve, is that your recollection?
Yes, it is, but I've got one question, if I may. John, you said that you thought in this case there was an undrawn element on a time basis. I don't understand what you mean by that.
There is an option to extend in this on the lender. The lender can, this is a 6-month loan that could roll every 6 months.
It isn't an undrawn facility, something that the borrower has the ability to draw down, which isn't the case in this situation.
So is that around the definition of being a firm commitment as opposed to optionality, or is it around drawn versus undrawn?
I don't think there's any optionality for the borrower in this case. There's an option for the lender to carry on lending.
I think the analogy to the similarity to the perhaps other types of commitments is because the idea of extending the beyond the maximum contractual period is you're applying it under 5520 to things where the lender can say, well, I'm cancelling the facility, I don't have to lend to you, but 5520 says, well, you can account for that commitment on a behavioural basis, even though it goes beyond what you're maximum contractual exposure is, and I guess the thing is, well, here, yeah, there's an ability to extend at the end of 6 months,
and personally,
and
I
that
don't
could be cancelled beforehand. But 5520 would say, well, don't worry about the fact it could be cancelled beforehand if you applied 5520.
but I still think that it wasn't really the potential for it to be. I don't think it was the sort of uncertainty of whether extra would be drawn down per se that we were focusing on. It was more these revolving things where there were uncertain amounts and a sort of maximum and you'd be oscillating. I really think that was what we were driving at, and maybe we should remind people of what's in the basis and trying to describe the scope, because it was a difficult thing, but that was the concept we're trying to hinge on, if that's going to be helpful for people to understand where 5520
I think that would be
starts.
Very helpful. Be so very I think helpful. We're going to have lots of questions around
George.
Well, I was going to say, when I tried to explain 5520 to clients, I always thought you did this kind of analysis at inception, at origination, and what are the attributes of the facility, whether you get into it or not, and it's not something we'd have to constantly reconsider whether it's fully drawn or fully undrawn. And frankly, I think that makes
it's the nature of the instrument.
Correct. So, but do you agree that looking at it at origination, the facility's attributes at origination, is the right way to look at it?
Yes, I think so. Off the top of my head, it's the ability. It's the fact that it has the potential to do these things. Chris.
I was going to say, maybe to say literally at origination might cause other problems, because it's probably zero draw on that origination.
But are the terms of the instrument such that that is how it could behave, rather than, you know, does it have to be on this day or on day five, or the reporting date, or reassessed over time? Yeah. Oh, sorry, Bill.
I think most of the points I would have wanted to have made have been made. I think the... it's one where we should just be mindful of the potential for unintended consequences, because as I think has been articulated, it would lead to a situation where if you structured the mortgage in a certain way, you would only count a 6 months maturity, whereas in another jurisdiction you might structure it as a 20 or 30 years. And so that, you know, the rules are clear, there is no dispute or doubt on that, but it is one of those areas which, for, if you say for credit risk management purposes, how would you actually manage it and model it and measure it? You would look at the behavioural maturity of these types of instruments to manage your portfolio of these instruments. You know, so there is a subtle disconnect between how you would deal with it for credit risk management purposes from how the accounting would ask you to.
Yes.
There could be a difference between the two. Is that what you're saying,
yes.
Bill?
Yes.
So I think we're all agreeing, and I think it is a good clarification to include in the summary, that don't just read the words and ignore the environment. Look at whether they're substantive terms. But I think you could have a situation where your expectation would be that you're going to continue to renew, even though you legally have the right, and there's no fettering on it whatsoever, to walk away from it. And even if you were thinking about it differently from a credit perspective, you'd need to be mindful of what 5519 says that it could cut you off. Yeah? You're not saying anything different. Good. Steve, did you want to come on?
Yeah, to Bill's point, surely credit risk management, whilst looking at the behavioural life of these things, would differentiate between a borrower option to extend and a lender's option to extend.
Yeah, it's difficult for me to give sort of you know, precisely how you deal with it, because we don't do this sort of product. But when I talk to other colleagues that do have these sorts of instruments, I think they don't make a distinction between, you know, it's just accepted as market practice.
Okay.
So I think there could be a disconnect between the credit and the accountant, which is important to emphasise. You don't just follow what the credit thinking is. Yeah.
And that's the thing I just flagged. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right, I think we can wrap that one up, and we'll make sure we make the point about the substantive nature of it, and we'll try and help you with some colour in terms of the scope of 5520, and we'll use the basis as much as we can to do that rather than inventing new words. All right, which leads us on to revolving credit facilities, paper 4. And Bernadette, you again.
So agenda paper 4 addresses two issues raised by one of our submitters regarding the application of the impairment requirements to a portfolio of revolving credit card exposures. So following on really from part of the discussions that we've been having on agenda paper 1. So there are two issues addressed here, so I'm going to summarise the first issue and then ask for your views before moving on to the second. So the first issue relates to the determination of the appropriate period to consider when measuring expected credit losses. And as noted in the other agenda paper that we've just been discussing, for specific financial instruments, such as certain portfolios of revolving credit facilities, IFRS 9 does permit a period in excess of the contractual commitment period to be used as the maximum period to consider when measuring your expected credit losses. And IFRS 9 also goes on to provide guidance about how an entity should determine that appropriate period. And so the submitter questions the application of these requirements in the context of a large portfolio of revolving credit facilities held by a bank. At the reporting date, the bank has identified that 75% of the portfolio has not suffered an significant increase in credit risk and is considered to be in stage one. 20% of the portfolio has suffered a significant increase in credit risk and is considered to be in stage two. And furthermore, within that stage two portfolio, it's expected that half of the assets within that portfolio will go on to default, whereas the other half will most likely cure. And the remaining 5% of the portfolio are credit impaired and are considered to be in stage three. So the example then goes on to describe the various credit risk management policies of the bank, how it determines whether there's been a significant increase in credit risk and the credit risk management actions that might be undertaken when such an event occurs. And the submitter asks then how to determine the appropriate period over which to measure expected credit losses for assets in each of the individual stages, and questions whether it might be appropriate perhaps to have different periods depending on the different stages. So having considered that issue, we would just make the following points before opening this up for discussion. So the appropriate period over which to measure expected credit losses for assets in all stages must always represent the period over which the entity is expected to be exposed to credit risk, and expected credit losses would not be mitigated by the entity's normal credit risk management actions. And also, once an entity estimates that appropriate period using the guidance in IFRS 9, the measurement of expected credit losses then follows the general guidance set out in IFRS 9. So there will still be a requirement to measure lifetime expected credit losses on all financial instruments for which there has been a significant increase in credit risk since initial recognition, and also 12-month expected credit losses, which are still a portion of lifetime expected credit losses on financial instruments for which there has not been a significant increase in credit risk since initial recognition. So having made those points, we would just like to seek your views on the issues raised by the submitter and the specific questions about the determination of that appropriate period for the assets in each stage.
Now, I think what we were planning to do here is where I'm hoping the ITG is really going to come into its own, is this is for people lucky enough to have got into the scope of 5520, who are then sent to BB539. And what I thought would be good would be if some of the banks could talk to us and explain to us how, when they're implementing IFRS 9, they're thinking about applying the words we have in the standard to determine what the life is that they should be using to apply the standard. So, Bill, were you going to kick that off?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Sue. So, no pressure.
No pressure, Bill.
So, I was going to start, and if we deal with the measurement thing. Just to sort of say something about the fact pattern to start with, the fact pattern is in itself interesting because when you're dealing with revolving credit facilities, when you define an average life of 5 years, is that when the account closes? Is it when it runs to zero and there are no further drawdowns? Is it something else that people have in mind? Because typically with the revolving credit facilities, and then I'll come back onto the fact pattern, the nature of the product is such that the actual duration will be potentially much longer than that. And if you think about it, and we'll talk about it in the second part of the question, but it's relevant in terms of the consideration of the measurement. You'll have a credit card potentially for many years. So you would probably segment the portfolio into these sort of different sections or categories for the measurement. But if we take 1A, which is the and I think at its core to all of this is you're looking at what's the probability of default, what's the exposure that you're expecting if the account were to default, so how much are you expecting to have drawn down at each of the period dates, and then what is the loss expected on recovery, even if that would extend beyond the sort of 12-month time horizon. And so a simplified way of thinking about the stage one, or 1A to the question, would be you would just take a PD at month 12, and then you would multiply what you thought that the exposure was likely to be, multiplied on again by the loss you're expecting on recovery. In stage one, you're clearly guided towards the average life, which is 2.5 years. The way you would probably operationalize this, then I'm actually in Jorg's camp from earlier on. You would do this calculation on a sort of monthly basis, and you would look at the patterns of drawings and undrawns for each of those sort of monthly period snapshots, if you will, and then take them forward. One discussion point that we've had, and I know it's been discussed at industry level, is discounting and how you deal with that. It's quite clear from the standard that you're expected to discount back to today's values, recognizing that some future money is not the same as money received today. But when you're operationalizing it in stage one, would you continue to discount? And I think, is it necessary to discount? As opposed to would you continue? And so I think there would be, you would probably test for that in terms of whether it's there. Into the stage two elements, where you've got from the fact pattern 50% expected to have defaulted, then it's quite clear that you would take life for those, which from the facts would be 4.5 months plus whatever the recovery period is that you would add on for going beyond there. And for the stage, for the 50% of the stage two that expected to cure, then you would take that out to the 2.5 years as the example cited in the paper, to have some sort of blended estimate of what the best guess of the loss would be from those separate sort of components. Because remembering and recognizing that you're dealing with probabilities at that stage, you don't know which of the population are going to actually go on to default and which are the ones which are actually going to come back into the in-order population and cure. There was a supplementary question in there about what do you do with the question, with those accounts which cure and then subsequently go back into stage two. And we would certainly see that as a future event to be dealt with in stage two. But you need to check your sort of measurement stats that those, the 50% default banding that you've applied does take into account those which will have cured and then defaulted at some future date.
that makes sense.
Can I ask you a question, Bill?
Yeah.
So you refer to the expected life of 2.5 years quite a lot. And if I look at B5540, that feels like that's subparagraph A, so the period over which the entity was exposed to credit risk on similar financial instruments. How are you taking... This isn't a trick question, I'm interested.
No, no.
How can you explain how you're taking into account C, the fact that on a sort of monthly basis or whatever it is in a fact pattern, that you've got the ability to sort of see whether something's happening and to act as a result? How are you taking into account your sort of credit risk mitigation actions? Because if you look at the basis where it describes what the sort of idea was here, it wasn't purely behavioural, it was taking into account, you know, the period over which you're exposed to credit risk, taking into account your credit risk mitigation activities. So how is that being built into the analysis?
And that's why I say that the example is a sort of simplified example, because what you would do is, once an account actually moves into stage two, you would start to monitor, manage it in a more dynamic, different way. And so, in that example, if you're taking management actions, that's why you're getting a shorter sort of outcome period, and that's reflected in the modeled results which you're using as your basis for your fact pattern. So what I haven't done here is to sort of substitute, if you will, that sort of higher granularity that you would actually operate from. I've just tried to respond to the
So do you
question.
Mean do you, that the credit risk mitigation activities are sort of implicit in the two
They're
and
implicit
years?
In that's how I've understood the example, and that's how I've taken the example. So I've tried to stick to the example. Paul, did you want to
To me, I think the important thing is trying to determine that expected lifetime. You know, and what are you used to, in which to base that expected lifetime? I do see the lifetime for expected credit losses being quite different to almost some of the way it's pictured here, which is more around life of the product. So the way we would look at doing it is looking at historically how that portfolio, because the only way you can do it is on a portfolio basis. So historically, looking at how your portfolio has behaved since points at which you originated the loan. And you'd look at, you know, after 1 year, what level of default or loss have you experienced, what level, you know, 2 years, etc. And being generally, you know, portfolio like this, most of your losses would come in the early stages since origination. And I think you've got to continue measuring until some point you feel the majority of the loss or the default has occurred. And that starts to define the period over which you experience credit losses. I think as soon as you've got some idea as to what you define as your lifetime, then it starts to become easy to determine what do you calculate. And stage one becomes quite easy. Stage two is the more difficult, because you've got to consider that full lifetime until you reach a default position for stage two.
Yeah, it's almost, at what point does it go into an absolving state, you know, so such that you're not seeing each month when you're doing your monthly projections, you're not seeing any incremental, you know, any significant incremental difference to the amount which is getting there. Once you've identified that population and that time period. And it will be different for the different sort of stratas or segments. Then I think that's what Paul said.
Oh, sorry, John.
Just the other bit. So I think the thing of, as Paul mentioned, trying to determine that lifetime. I think there's another bit to consider, is that it almost gives you your probability of default, what you recover. Once your account's gone into default, I think there's a different life expectancy and a different calculation for that, because as soon as you've reached that default point, your focus is around collecting cash flows, and that life of over which you collect cash flows could have a completely different period or makeup. So you have to be quite careful at distinguishing the lifetime of the loan until you get to default compared to the actual recovery of cash flows, mm-hmm. should it reach a default position.
John.
I'd agree with the comments about Bill and Paul. Really what we're trying to grapple with here is the extra or the added complexity that's added to these products, because we're looking at a behavioural life, if you like, as opposed to a contractual life. So we're trying to figure out what will be the period of what amount are we exposed to when we calculate our expected credit loss. And maybe if I look at it in stage one and then it rolls on to stage two and three, if you think about it in stage one, you'll in this example, the average life of the book is 2.5 years, so I think the average life of default is 18 months, if I can remember it right. But really we're looking at trying to calculate what is our 12-month expected credit loss for stage one. So we don't need to look at a period outside 12 months per se. Maybe you might look at recoveries past 12 months, but you're looking at a period within 12 months. But if you think about it, if you've got a loan, if you've got a credit card at the start of the year, you might want to think of how much will default in month one, how much will default in month two, how much will default in month three, how much will default in month four, and so on. Because the amount that defaults in month one will be the balance at the end of the year plus what you expect to be drawn down between at the year end and month one. The amount of defaults in month six will be balanced at the end of the year plus what might happen in the next 6 months. They could be two different things. Mm-hmm. So therefore you may need to look at an expected life of at the end of month for those that will default in month one at being a 1 month expected life, or it may be a 1 month expected life plus a 2 month recovery period, so you may be looking at over 3 months for the actual calculation. But certainly from the people I've been talking to, they kind of think they may need to break down the probabilities of there being default on a monthly basis, and you have some sort of matrix type approach to determine the calculation, just so you can deal with that added complexity around determining what is the amount on which we have to calculate that. And then that flows on into lifetime expected credit loss, and it flows on, I think, to your question is 2.5 years, and I think Bill's right, it's way too simplistic. You'd have to probably do something similar for the lifetime, and then you'd have to look at cures. My own view is you should take into account the propensity of something failing, curing again, but you probably roll that up into your overall stats, as Bill said, your overall stats. What is my likely cure over the 2.5 year period, and then I'll apply that back. I think phase three is much more straightforward. You've terminated the card, which is a straightforward calculation, I think. And I think the principle set out in the staff paper, I think, supports that kind of matrix type approach. I think to get it right, again, given by the guidelines of materiality, you have to get it to a point where you feel that you've broken those intervals down into an appropriate period. We're breaking them down any further, it doesn't make sense from a materiality perspective. And I think that's probably where the bigger decision is going to have to be taken.
Statistical perspective.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Steve?
This submission confused me with all these different periods. Isn't the 12-month allowance pretty simple? It's 12-month PD and then the lifetime loss weighted according to that 12-month PD. This seems to be overcomplicated.
But the question is, if you have a credit card and you're looking at the 12-month PD, but if you have the ability to have a credit risk management procedure at the end of month two. So let's say in month one the credit card's going to default, you'll stop it. So you're actually only looking at a 1 month period, because that is the period. And it was more, I think the question was more about how do I interlay the 12 month and the lifetime with the calculation of my expected life, or my expected life maybe in smaller buckets.
So I think I was going to ask a similar question. So my understanding, just to make sure we're all on the same page, is you're going to look at what the probability is of a default occurring over the next 12 months, and you might might segment your portfolio in a way that makes it easier to analyse. Then when you're considering what the consequence of that default is, you're looking at what losses would arise over whatever time period that unfolds.
Yes. Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. We're all on the same page then. All right. Did people have anything they wanted to add to that?
Noel? I think you mentioned paragraphs A, B, and C in B5.5.40, and what I've encountered in my own experience is that people focus on one of those paragraphs, and I know there's an and between them, and either they're in the school of, I monitor very closely, as I think they articulate in the example here, and therefore this should be measured in months, mm-hmm. or I'm looking at the behavioral life of a product which may have been going on for a long time, and things like overdraft features in current accounts. I've been with my bank and had a current account for over 30 years. Are they going to say that they should use periods that are measured in years, you know, 10 years, 15 years or more? And these are smart people all reading these words and yet coming up with radically different answers. And I think part of it is they're not looking at the and requirement. And there may also be the influence of regulators who perhaps have a point of view of how long they'd like you to try to forecast these losses. The longer the period, the bigger the reserves are going to be. And so I think, you know, to me, this question, above all the other questions you folks have posed, really does beg for more examples that try to do exactly what you asked, Sue, is if you're going to have a period, tell me how you tie it back to the paragraph C in the credit risk mitigation. And if you can't, like even in the example you guys have at the back that was in the standard, I think you used 30 months, there's really no logic as to why the 30 months was picked. What is, why wasn't it 24? Why wasn't it 36? Why wasn't it 5?
Yeah, it wasn't.
And so I think if this is the one thing, I'd like to see more examples done that try to make that connection. Otherwise, whether it was intended or not, this behavioral life stuff seems to be kind of what people in credit world would otherwise like to try and use. And I don't personally think that's what you intended here, but I would be interested in your thoughts. I thought your question was a good one, because that's what I want to ask my clients all the time too.
Well, I want to listen to this discussion to see if it helps us in the first instance, but I guess if I can go back to the banks, and this is a bit mean because now I'm asking you to respond to George's question because I don't want to answer it. If you had the situation where you've got a portfolio of overdrafts, which, you know, some of which have a very long life, how are you taking into account the fact that this isn't just asking you what has the life been on instruments, it's saying also take into account your credit risk management actions. How are you reading that into this to bring us in shorter than 30 years, which was my understanding?
Shall I start? So I guess the first thing I'd say is it's work in progress. So by which I mean we're doing some sort of, we're at the sort of analysis design phase. We're doing some sort of model prototypes. We're taking different portfolios with different product characteristics to try and answer those questions. What we're doing is looking at what our historical experience, you know, it's no different to how you would construct any other sort of model, insofar as you look at your historical experience over a sort of a time period, and then you project forward to what are the finite states that you can actually observe and measure. And so we spoke about, mentioned a couple of those in terms of has the customer left, so there's clear closure, in which case what were my loss experiences at that stage? Is it that the behavioral patterns have changed materially, significantly, so that I've got a different fact line, and then what we're trying to do is to understand what are the drivers of those differences from both a sort of a customer behavior, customer type, as well as a, let's call it a geography or sort of environment macro type. So I think it's no different in that regard, so in terms of how we're approaching it. Part of that is joining together our customer information in terms of what's actually a customer and account information with our collections and recovery data and the information and profiles
from that. And then, George, to your point, it's how segmented does that become? It becomes segmented to the point where either you're managing it differently, or the characteristics are sufficiently different that you would want it to be treated differently.
In response to what George has said, I think it's something we need to watch for sure, because I think it's one of the harder areas, and this is one of the reasons why moving beyond contractual is tricky. So it's narrow scope, but still obviously matters a lot. But the words in the standard say the period, it's not the period over which you expect the instrument to be outstanding. It says the period over which you expect to be exposed to credit risk. I wonder whether emphasising that in a summary would be helpful, and a reminder that this is an and, so you need to think about all of these things. Because what I'm hoping, and I won't aim this question at anyone in particular because that's probably unfair, so I'll speak to the banks generally, is what I'm hoping is that even if for an overdraft type such as George's overdraft, the expectation is that the instrument may well be outstanding for 30 years, you're not really exposed to credit risk over 30 years, because I'm presuming that if you're all active credit managers, you have lots of opportunities between now and year 30, if something goes wrong, to step in and say, I'm taking that line away. Yes?
Maybe to add to the bill, we are also in the process of analyzing, and I think what's important to really differentiate different types of clients and products, and also to think about in which stage we are on. So when we think, for example, a large corporate, they have credit facilities. I was told when one of these clients enter this the stage two, the time until they default is very often pretty short. So the time over where we have to calculate lifetime expected losses in stage two might be pretty short, because as I said, the time until the client then finally defaults is pretty short. So these are the fallen angels very often. This might be very different to mid-cap clients entering stage two until they finally default. So what I want to say is, I think in the context of implementation and finding the appropriate solution, we need to really look into how long we are really exposed to the credit risk until the client enters stage three. This might be a solution to find the appropriate application here.
Sorry, I missed the order of cards for Paul.
But I was just going to support that comment around it's important to emphasize that piece over which you experience credit risks. I think that's the important bit in terms of trying to determine how to actually work this out. I think you do have examples where you do have loans going out to 20 or 30 years, but realistically, you first of all, to measure or try and calculate over that period, it's just going to become unrealistic. You tend to find, as you've mentioned, is most of your credit risk will be in the early periods of the loan. And once you have an experience of somebody who's not had an increased credit risk for 20 years, there's generally very low probability of further credit risk. So you have to be practical around choosing a point at which you think the majority of the credit risk has been experienced. And you can't just practically go out to these sort of huge tiers.
Chris?
Yeah, maybe I'm just very slow, but I'm confused and don't really understand this distinction between the period over which you expect the instrument to be outstanding and the period over which you expect to be exposed to credit risk, because I read 5540 and I'd have thought the two were the same. And I imagine, the period over, if the instrument's outstanding, you're exposed to credit risk, and your expectations around what will happen also will obviously reflect your credit risk management action. So I'm just not getting the distinction that people are seeking to make. Unless this is just an argument to say, well, I don't really want to go out 20 years or 30 years because that's difficult or inconvenient, which I'm not understanding what the conceptual basis is for that. Some of the things I didn't quite understand around the example, maybe it's just loose wording. It talks about having these two sub-portfolios of things in stage two, those which are expected to default and those which are expected not to default. whereas I get the impression they're not really suffering failures. You're just, you're looking at that bunch and you're saying, I think that 50% will default in the short term, and I think that 50%, well, they won't default in the short term, or they'll default in the short term and then cure. And but they're not really sub portfolios, they're just applying your statistical parameters across the whole pot of stage two. And then maybe this, tying into one of Paul's comments and the next issue we've got to deal with, it sounds like if you get a real heavy experience of losses early in the life of an instrument, that does suggest, well, that maybe that would be a separate portfolio. You know, you got to model that separately. It's got different characteristics from something that's had a year's seasoning.
Yeah.
And I guess also the idea of how long the instrument is outstanding, maybe this is what the signature you're getting at. You know, once you get into issue two, we seem to have a question around, well, when do these types of instruments, as it were, get de-recognised or considered to be new instruments? And I guess that might, you know, as you start looking out over a period of time and exposed to credit risk, I would imagine that if something got de-recognised under the analysis in issue two, then that would bring to an end its life for the purposes of 5540.
Martin?
Yeah. And my understanding why we have granted this exception, it was okay because we thought, okay, for this credit facilities, it is really, if you can cancel it every day, the contractual period was is not appropriate. And therefore we said, okay, because we have this problem also with undrawn drawn, and therefore I think we should come up with a kind of different time where we calculate really then the lifetime. But my understanding was it was only limited because what was told to us from banks is could we reviewing this kind of exposure maybe every year. And that is, if you're reviewing it every year, my understanding was if it is reviewed every year and then it found, okay, there's a problem with this, that is then cancelled.
Yep.
And if it is cancelled, I think there is not any exposure for credit risk, and therefore I think that is for me the maximum period. And I think, and therefore what Bill said, I think when you assumed when you answer it is 2.5 years, yes, if that is the case, but I would not think that banks doing it only every 2.5 years. I would imagine it is done at least every year, and therefore I think, okay, this maximum period is maybe 1 year. But I think it is this limiting factor is both when a credit review is done, and based on this review, a bank is making the decision to cancel this facility. And it is not really what the banks expect, okay, maybe if nothing happens, it is maybe 30 years. I think that exactly, or for me, that was not the period over which we should calculate it. It's then limited to this credit review, however you call it, and then based on this review, you're taking actions, and after these actions, you are not any longer exposed to this credit risk. That was my understanding.
Why I asked how that was being taken into account. If it's okay, George, I'm just going to
go
to Bill and then back to you in case Bill has a response to Martin's question.
The nature of the credit card portfolios, they're managed in a subtly different way to the way the sort of corporate type portfolios are managed. The management is much more dynamic than an annual review. You may or may not actually perform an annual review. What you tend to do is to monitor on a monthly basis or even on a sort of transaction. So because so much of the decisioning is automated, you're actually monitoring dynamically what's happening, and you're looking for changes in behavior, which might be akin or equivalent to the type of monitoring that takes place on an annual review. But you don't go back to the customer at that point and say, can you give me your details on your income and earnings and all of those other things that you would do. There have been changes in circumstances. You're trying to pick that up from the information that you've got and how the facilities are being used, and when people, what sort of information is available at the bureau, credit bureaus, for example. So I just wouldn't want people to go away with the notion that every credit card facility has and is subject to an annual review. it just doesn't work that way.
But that sounded to me like it's subject to a monthly.
It's monthly, no.
In which case, why are we only going out 30 days? Well, how then is C then would be saying take into account, B5540C would be saying take into account for the credit cards. Every 30 days you've got the opportunity to say I've had enough.
So how are you taking that into account? Well, sorry, I was going to say what I remember from the discussions as well was how likely is it that the bank is actually going to call the facilities at those times. So that was an important sort of component of that conclusion.
So maybe for a portion of the population you're saying the 30 days might really
pick up. And that's why I spoke earlier on about the segmentation, because for some customers, so if you think about the population, and Chris said, I don't understand, this cures gets better and sort of gets worse again, but if I land in stage two and I've been in stage two X number of times before, or if I'm landing in stage two and it's the first time that I've ever got there, I'm not necessarily going to manage those two types of customers in quite the same way. I'm going to have different protocols and procedures that I will follow to chase out.
But for me, it is really the main point is, okay, when you're doing certain procedures to identify, okay, maybe the customer has a problem, and after you have identified, you will draw a consequence, maybe to reduce or to cut the line. And that is for me kind of a relevant factor, because when we're discussing not having stake on the contractual term, instead doing something different. That is our discussion. And something different is okay, because if it is not a contractual term, when you ask, maybe then based on your risk management actions, when you then cancel or reduce the lines. And that is for me then, if you're doing that every month, that was based on your answer was okay, if I get information from the credit bureau every month, then maybe it is every month, because then hopefully you draw the conclusion.
But I don't quite, what seems to be coming through from what you're saying, I get more flavour of, it's almost like, well, if the bank's got the opportunity to review the credit line every month or every year, then that's setting a limit on how far I look of a month or a year. Yeah. But that's not what the words here say. The words here say, what's the expectations you have around the risk management actions you will take? And I guess if you've got historical data, which presumably reflects your risk management actions, shows that things could bounce around in stage two for a year, or 2 years, or 3 years, go into stage two, come out again, go back again. I mean, that's real information that presumably reflects your expectations and how you actually manage credit risk.
But this is going back to your question about what distinction are we making between the life and the period over which you're exposed to credit risk, and I think it's this idea that, okay, we accepted that it wasn't really one day because you were going to be oblivious to whether things were good or bad. We accepted that, so that made us go beyond the contractual maturity. But I think one of the important things, and maybe it's, you know, appropriately accommodated by segmenting the portfolio, but I think one of the important things that we were trying to focus on, and why the words exposed to credit risk matter, is based on how you manage this credit risk, how frequently do you have the opportunity to get out of that exposure?
But I think if I read the whole thing, exposed to credit risk, but for which expected credit losses would not be mitigated.
Would not be mitigated.
Credit risk management actions.
So maybe that's how they're doing it, but anyway. George.
Well, so, you know, this debate, I think, highlights the fact that there is confusion. I think these folks have spent lots of time with the standard, and there doesn't appear to me to be clear agreement as to where you belong in the spectrum between contractual life and behavioral life. I mean, a lot of people wanted me to ask, so I'll say it, why didn't you guys just pick behavioral life? Because everybody seems to understand what that is. It would be more consistent. It would also give you a much larger allowance, because those dates would tend to push out for these products. But you chose not to use those words. And so, you know, to me, this issue about, well, maybe it's really it's the period until the next management review or the next management option to cancel comes up, whatever that date is. If it's shorter, then you'll end up with smaller allowances. And if it's longer, and I've got some non-banking clients that issue charge cards that don't look at all. They wait for somebody to become delinquent. there's nothing done in the intervening time. They hope for the best. And so those folks, other things being equal, are going to have much larger reserves because the credit risk management is so radically different, and that's, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But this issue about the fact that none of these words are resonating, and there's I think almost two camps, short period, long period, highlights the need for examples that try to tie this back. Otherwise, all we'll get is inconsistency, and the only way to solve that is disclosures. In the disclosures, you're going to have to disclose what period you use for what product, and if it gets more complicated, to Bill's example, then you'd have to probably try to explain that as well.
That brings a lot of confusion into this example. Is there a difference between considering the loan as a single entity? So I think if you think of it as a single entity, you can understand the limitations and the management actions that happen on a regular basis. As soon as you start looking at your loan on a portfolio basis, even though you have all of these actions going on, what you start to track from a credit management perspective is more the characteristics of the portfolio, which brings you back into this whole concept of a behavioral concept. Because you're not trying to pull out each individual loan. You're trying to look at how does the portfolio collectively behave. And to me, the bit that resonates more is the concept of a behavioral life fits far more with the concept of to which period you're exposed to credit risk. But it only works when you're thinking of a portfolio of loans as opposed to a single loan.
I know that aligns more with what people economically think of, but I'm not sure that that was exactly what we were shooting for.
That is not only true for this kind of loans, that is maybe true for a broader.
John.
But if your credit risk management is reactive, which it is on a credit card basis, it has to take into account the delinquency of when the person actually goes bad. So if I've got a credit card and something happens and I miss a payment 2 years in, that's a five-year card. It's irrelevant as to whether someone's tracking on a daily basis what I've been doing. Something happened in 2 years' time which caused me to be delinquent, which caused them to stop the card, which made the period 2.5 years. So you have to take into account that interaction between the actions of the borrower and the reactive nature of how credit cards are measured.
I think that's why
the stratification is trying to get the earlier ones out, and then you're left with, if you like, in old-fashioned terms, the very good book. But there is a PD on the very good book, and we have to book the lifetime PD on the very good book. So it's trying to stratify the stuff that's going to go bad early. We're left with the balance, and then it's trying to get a practical way to measure that as well, I think.
Graham.
Thanks, Sue. Yeah, kind of. Dovetailing off of John's comment, Bill, I have a question for you. If you have a borrower that you know is not going to repay your extension of credit to him, are you going to extend him more credit?
If I know that,
yeah.
No.
Okay.
But to Paul's point, on a portfolio, then there will be some customers that will fit that pattern.
Yeah.
So I will measure, manage, monitor those differently.
And that's very much my point, is that I think we're maybe creating a little bit of a false distinction between behavior and rights, because I think they're going to tend to go together on a portfolio basis, that when you have the ability to exercise some right that will limit your credit risk exposure, you will, if you're with a borrower that where credit risk has gone north and you need to do that. So I think it's sort of a difference without distinction here, because I don't know too many people that say, I've identified you as a borrower who's not going to repay my loan, but I'm going to extend credit to you anyway. And on credit cards and other consumer products, you may not have an actual ability to limit your credit exposure until you've reached that point, right? So I think on a portfolio basis, there really isn't a distinction between behavior and this ability to limit your credit risk.
I think the best thing to do in terms of today's discussion will be in the write-up to emphasise what B5540 says, and the fact that there's these three things to consider in this concept of exposure to credit risk, and then I think we'll have to think about what, if anything, we need to do in terms of examples. So we'll leave that as that for the moment. If that's all right with everybody, because I don't think we can go any further where we are today with the words we've got to work with. the second question.
Okay, so the second issue in agenda paper 4 relates to how an entity should determine the initial date of recognition of the revolving credit facilities for the purposes of determining whether there has been an increase, a significant increase in credit risk. So IFRS 9 requires that at each reporting date, an entity should assess whether the credit risk on a financial instrument has increased significantly since initial recognition. The submitter presents an example of a bank which holds a large portfolio of revolving credit facilities, and the portfolio in question has a diverse customer base ranging from long-standing customers who've been with the bank for many years to new customers who've only recently opened an account. So the submitter asks how they would determine the date of initial recognition of the revolving credit facilities in order to determine how to make the assessment of significant increases in credit risks. So there's a number of approaches suggested by the submitter. In the first instance, they focus on determining the date of initial recognition of the original undrawn facility, whereas the other approaches focus on the determination of whether subsequent events, such as the issue of new credit card products, changes to credit limits or revised credit reviews, would result in a change in the point used to consider whether there has been a significant increase in credit risk. So the staff will just open this one up for discussion among the members, but before doing that, we'll just point out that under IFRS 9, the assessment of increases in credit risk does focus on the date of initial recognition of the financial instrument which is being accounted for and which is being assessed for significant increases in credit risk. And in this regard, IFRS 9 does provide guidance on the initial recognition date, both for financial assets and for loan commitments, for the purposes of applying the impairment requirements, including guidance on where a financial asset is recognised following a drawdown of a loan commitment. And IFRS 9 also acknowledges that sometimes the renegotiation or modification of a financial asset may sometimes lead to derecognition and sometimes not, but that IFRS 9 did not in any way change the derecognition guidance in IS 39. So that really is the second issue, and we've touched on it really already as part of the first discussion. So if I could just ask for your views on this one.
And I would have to say for me, this question was sort of on the edge of whether we thought it was an ITG question or not, because it really gets to the heart of recognition and derecognition. I know it has important consequences for the application of the impairment requirements, but it's not expected credit losses per se. But with that caveat, Bill,
okay,
you want to say
something? Yeah, no, thanks. I guess the first thing to say is that, and we've touched on some of this in the earlier discussion, that this is probably one of the biggest operational challenges of implementing IFRS 9 for the revolving credit facilities. Where we've got to in our sort of thinking around this is that the standard is clear, that you go back to when the contract was when the original card was issued, and only if there's been a substantial modification do you as you say, do you enter into a new arrangement. What we, so what I spoke about the prototyping that we're doing and the analysis, and so what we're sort of considering is that practically how would we operationalize that, because the scorecards that we would have used when a credit card was first issued, so Stephen sitting next to me, so when Stephen was first a student, would have been the point at which he was originally given a credit card. He then sort of got a job, then got married, then had kids, whatever else happens. He's still got that original instrument. The exposure, and this comes back to Martin's point about how you're managing this, the exposure against the instrument might go up and down So the limit would be increased or decreased depending on changes in circumstances that you became aware of, but you're still back in the old camp. So we sort of took our discussion on a little bit and thought, well, why is it important? Because we're trying to use that initial credit assessment as a point of reference so that we can understand what the changes are going to be. And then we also thought, is that something that is an issue for transition, or is it an issue for ongoing? But we're looking to use a combination of indicators, so the behavior which we've touched on in the card, in terms of if we've got other sort of monitoring which tells us this is a high risk type customer, we would do that, so that we'd supplement whatever we got from the original assessment with what the changes have been in behavior period on period to make sure that they remain current and appropriate for when we're reporting the expected credit losses. We're certainly looking at PD assessments by vintages. So when did we originate? Does that enable us to set some sort of absolute thresholds at that point of origination, which we can then use as a reference point so that we can see whether that significant deterioration has been material or not? But I think productionalizing this and sort of trying to identify some of the language has been, well, are we looking to try and capture the jumpers, so the people that go sort of into default pretty quickly, which you would have seen fairly early on in the life, or is it more the sort of the frog in hot water type syndrome where you see this gradual deterioration over time, and so having a reference point which is relevant in terms of capturing that is something we're also looking at. I think one of the other suggestions and discussions that we've had at an industry level is if you're using that point of initial recognition which the standard requires but you don't have it, are there sensible proxies or alternatives that you could use, such as the PD at the last reporting date, or such as the PD over a different time horizon, which could be used as a proxy to show that comparison. But other components, if you issue a new card, that's not really a new instrument, that's just an operational process, so we saw no change there. I guess I'll stop there.
I guess from my point of view, I think it's largely a question of unit of account, and when you know what piece of the facility are you accounting for, I think that's important. This proxy idea, I have to say, probably I didn't have very good face control when you used that example, Bill. Unfortunately, the camera's stuck on me. I'm not sure that's in the spirit.
So he was about that.
On transition, obviously, we've got special accommodation for the fact that we know that people may not have information on the date of initial recognition because it was historical, and there's practical ways around that that at the end up on whether it's low credit risk or not is the cut. But on an ongoing basis, I think saying as a proxy it was the PD as of the last reporting date, I'm not sure that's really in the spirit.
No, but I think it is how to get to picking up on movements period on period, so the significant...
But the requirement is from initial recognition.
No, I understand, but if you didn't have that data going back, then what people are doing is constructing the data.
On transition. Yeah, on transition, that's it. Okay, I didn't see the order, so I'll just go around the table. John?
Paul is first, Graham second, I was last.
All right, thank you. Assisting the chair, Paul.
I think Bill described probably the challenge and the thought process quite elegantly. I think important thing to note is just that the understanding of credit risk based on the stage of the card in terms of its life can be very, very different. And you might, you know, the process to actually evaluate at what stage you get a significant increase in credit risk could be substantially different. Now, if you compare a student loan where you have, for example, a student card where there's a very low limit, you would allow, I think, much greater flexibility around deterioration in credit risk based on your initial expectations. Whereas if you're looking at a card with the high limit and you're not expecting any adverse behavior, your definition of what you'd consider adverse or deterioration in credit risk would be substantially different.
And I'd agree with that. And that's why I think unit of account's important, because going back to the Steve Cooper example, I would imagine that there's been some point between Steve Cooper student credit card and Steve Cooper's current credit card where there's been a new credit card being accounted for. And so I'm not thinking that we'd start from his, I'm sure, very good quality student credit risk.
You say that, and we do have on the books and records people that have got the same credit card.
It's fine, but I don't think we're locking you into that. No, if you think that there's a more appropriate unit of account, I guess was the only point I was trying to make.
Yeah.
Sorry, Steve. Graham.
Steve, it makes you feel any better. I wasn't very credit worthy as a student either.
But you were.
I don't have the same credit card. Maybe he is. I mean, Sue and Bernard, first of all, great paper. I think we completely agree with the analysis. I think, to your point, Sue, this is a question really on the border of our charge here as an IDG, because I think the standard is quite clear that it's until you have derecognition, you can't have initial recognition. The question is, when do you have derecognition? What constitutes a significant modification? And, you know, internally we've kicked around within my firm and within the U.S. kicked around some ideas. I mean, clearly, I think when you have a whole new, not just a new physical card, but a whole new credit card system. So you go from a student card to an airline point card. Okay, that seems to be pretty clear. When you just increase and decrease credit limits on the same card, that becomes murky. And although there's certainly, oftentimes there might be a whole credit underwriting process that goes along with that, sometimes there might not be. Is that important? Because it's not, the standard isn't focused on the actions of the lender, it's focused on the modification of the terms of the agreement. So do you even consider the process that the lender goes through to modify the credit? It seems reasonable that you might, because I think the principle behind IFRS 9 is that, you know, or the principle behind the contractual term is that that's when you've re-looked at the credit and you've basically got a new exposure. And it seems like in order to have that, the lender's actions are important, but that's not part of the literature. So it's a difficult question.
Judgment, I think.
Yeah.
John.
Graham's sort of said most of what I was going to say. I mean, it is interesting. It is. I'm happy we're discussing it today, because it is critical to the calculation of these things, and it's critical actually to the first half of the conversation we said, because they really are, if not perfect sides of the same coin, they're two sides of the same coin. And I think you would take into account your deliberations, you know, credit reviews, but I think just if you do, you might do a credit review and not issue a new card, so that in itself is problematic. Mm-hmm. You might automatically increase a limit because that's what, you know, the market requires in terms of being competitive. You might argue if you double a limit, it may be a different loan, you may not. It's difficult, and I think, you know, people are going to have to get to a practical waterline as to what is and isn't, and I think that would be important to just the industry keep close on you know, the arguments to determine when you have a significant change in the cash flows, which would mean you have a derecognition event. But like there needs to be also a practicality brought into it. I think that's what Bill was kind of alluding to when he was looking at PDs. I mean, if your PD has radically decreased over time, it's probably a different card because the risk has changed. So it's just, I think, you know, there's a necessity for a practical overlay here to get this thing to work as well.
I think that the most useful thing we can probably do as a group, if you agree, in terms of sort of noting what our key takeaways would be, is to sort of confirm what was in the analysis of question two in the paper, which is it ultimately comes down to a question of do you have a new instrument and what's the starting point of this instrument, that we have guidance such as the modifications, that judgments would be involved, but some of the things you might think about, and we can list some of the things that were discussed in the meeting and provide that as a help at the moment, because I think it needs to be tied in with the sort of recognition concepts, but because IFRS 9 itself isn't black and white about how to do that, the best we can do is to point people to those are the judgments that they should be making judgments to make that assessment, and that's what they should be doing. With that, I'm hoping that we can declare at lunchtime and come back at 2 o'clock.